Thank you for staying for the last presentation of the last IES on the last day. That's very nice of you. So as you listen to our speakers, clearly one must have an irrational sense of optimism to do a lot of this work. This is very different than doing traditional lab-based work. I think often in terms of the families that we hope to reach, the settings in which we hope to implement these interventions, and the way our interventions need to adapt in order to fit appropriately with these families and these settings. And I want to talk a little bit about some conceptual models and some practices that we've put in place that I think may help with this. Connie had originally entitled this presentation "Lessons from the Field." I think what we did wrong is a better approach, because it's not what you did wrong; it's a teachable moment for you. So what I hope to cover here is are these questions: why should we care about this? What's different about these settings in which we hope to implement these interventions? And then talk a little bit about some of the implementation strategies themselves and the models that inform those strategies, ways in which we might reconceptualize some of these interventions, and then finally maybe some practical things about how that should inform our study questions and designs. And a lot of this is based on a large randomized field trial that we conducted in partnership with the School District of Philadelphia that Aubin referenced, in which we compared two classroom-based instructional programs. One is STAR, Strategies for Teaching Based on Autism Research, which comprises discrete trial training, pivotal response training, and teaching and functional routines with a curriculum. And we compared that to an implementation of structured teaching. And I'm not going to talk so much about the results of that study as some of the what we've learned from it in terms of the process for this kind of study design. So why should we care? Well, this is in the U.S. this has become a very popular slide. This is the number of children served with autism in the special education system in the United States. In the late 90s, they comprised less than 1% of all children in special education. They now comprise more than 6% of all children in special education, and their numbers have increased dramatically. So this is separate from the community prevalence of autism. It's how many really are being treated in U.S. schools. And these, in general, are very expensive children to educate, at least given the models that we have now. It's very difficult for us to get expenditure data in the education system in the U.S., but most of the data we have suggests that expenditures for children with autism are about three times that of children in general education, and the only category that's more expensive to educate our children in multiple disabilities category of special education. Of course, a lot of those kids have autism as well. And I think in part districts are really struggling to figure out what the best strategy is to help these kids. I consult with a lot of school districts about their autism programming, and the first question I always ask is, tell me about your current programming for children with autism. And this is one list that I got from a very wealthy district about when I asked what interventions do. They do discrete trail, which may be different than discrete trial, but you know, I won't read this list. This is a huge list. Some of these interventions are sort of contraindicated. That is, you wouldn't do them both with the same kid. I can't imagine how one develops a set of expertise in all of these interventions concurrently. And you'll see at the bottom that they use these strategies. This is verbatim, by the way, that they use these strategies for all settings, ages, and grades, based on the individual needs of the child. And of course, we all want to meet the individual needs of the child. But it's very, you know, this is one way to do it, but it's a very challenging way. And as I said, this is in a very wealthy district. It's when you're talking about districts with even more limited resources, this is sort of what they're up against as a model. That is, when parents come to them to talk about what they want for their child when they're negotiating the IEP, parents may have any number of these things in mind. And often for these under-resourced districts, their response is very reactive. That is, they're responding to the family saying, no, we can't do that, rather than having a model in place that they say, well, this is what we can offer, and this is why we think it's appropriate for your child. And that's one way that we as researchers can really help a lot of these districts, is to help them to have a more proactive approach to conceptualizing what their autism services look like. And one of the reasons we were able to get into the schools was because of the number of lawsuits, due process hearings, and grievances brought against the district by families. And we said, you know, we can help you with that by helping you articulate what you use in the district and making it evidence-based. And this is not, you know, we work in Philadelphia, it's the fifth largest school district in the country. We can look at the 100 largest school districts in the U.S., right? And these are enormous places. So New York serves 1 million children in the school district in the city of New York. Los Angeles is 650,000. San Diego is number 15, I think. And how many? Who knows? Anyway, it's a lot of, and so they're all over the U.S. These 100 largest districts, there are 17,800 school districts in the U.S. So the top 100, about 0.6% of all districts, serve almost 1 in 4 children in the U.S. The top 500 by size, so 2.8% of all school districts, serve 43% of all children in the U.S. These children are disproportionately poor. These districts are disproportionately under-resourced. These places are battleships, but these are the places where the kids are. And if we can think about the qualitative differences that these districts face and help them to reshape their autism services, we can dramatically change care and hopefully outcomes for children with autism and their families by intervening in a relatively few number of places. And so I think, and we can also, I mean, there are other underserved areas too. There are rural areas as well. There are families within wealthy districts who are not getting the services they need. But I think there's really a lot of reason to think about focusing our care and how we can partner with places in these urban settings. And I would argue that almost any country in the world with sufficient land mass is going to have the same kind of disproportionate population, and that targeting heavily populated areas is a way to change care and outcomes for a lot of kids. So this is how I conceptualize the life of a teacher of children with autism in the public school system. I don't know how many of you are Calvin and Hobbes fans. I was a huge Calvin and Hobbes fan. My mother said that's because we had some behavioral and temperamental similarities, right? But this is Calvin pulling his sled up a steep hill, and he's not happy about it. And so you can think about that as the life of a teacher with autism. Their lives are hard. And we often go into the classroom and think we're going to give them a thing. The thing is a program. Right? The thing is an evidence-based practice. It's extra training, it's teaching and functional routines, discrete trial training, pivotal response training, a new curriculum. And what we've done is we've loaded their sled. We've made their life harder by offering them this thing, right? At least preliminarily we've made it. So why would they want to partner with us, especially when they have to deal with the boulders in front of them, which include a resentful aide in the classroom who's not, you know, who doesn't feel that they're given the respect that they're due, an irate principal who doesn't know why she give over a whole classroom in her already overcrowded school to 8 kids when she can fit 33 in a different classroom, and so they get these tiny classrooms that they're trying to operate in. And that's the environment of many of the teachers that are working in these settings. And I think we need to be very cognizant of that when approaching teachers and schools as partners, that they have a whole different set of issues. Sometimes we think as intervention developers, well, don't they want their kids to get better? And of course they want their kids to get better. But that's a value we share, and it's a value that can bring us both to the table. But we have to think about conceptualizing this in a very different way that doesn't make them defensive about the many things that they need to accomplish as well, and where we can learn from them as much as think about, as one implementation science calls it, the empty vessel approach. That is, they are an empty vessel that we will fill with our knowledge, right? And that's not a great attitude to walk into a partnership with. So the way that I think about this, and Aubyn alluded to this, but it's really the same issue, is that we have efficacy trials in university settings where we get grant funding that ensures that the intervention is delivered the way it was designed, that we've highly trained and supervised clinicians who are all a little afraid of you because they worked for you and it's your intervention. And we can have highly restrictive inclusion and exclusion criteria. There's nothing unreasonable about saying that the only kids in this intervention have to be toilet trained, no self-injurious behavior, and have at least 5 words. Right? Those would be no review committee would blink at those exclusion criteria. And you compare that with community practice, where the intervention is very much subject to programmatic and funding priorities, and depends what is exciting the administration that year, that you have variable training, supervision, and motivation and caseload for the clinicians or teachers who are working in these settings. In large part, their motivation is variable because they had to do something, you know, last year it was DSTAR math, and this year it's reading mastery, and now you want us to do STAR, and why, we know it's going to be something new next year, so why should we invest? And they don't get exclusion criteria. So it turns out it's illegal in the U.S. to say that you won't take a kid into your class because they're self-injurious, not potty trained, and have fewer than 5 words. So we're dealing with very different settings when we think about the test of efficacy, that is, does the intervention work in ideal circumstances versus effectiveness? Does it work in the settings where we ultimately hope it will be used? And we learn a lot about how to address this from the study of corn. So early in the 20th century, there was a move towards using hybrid seed and different practices. We want farmers to harvest their hay when it's not quite at full height because the protein content is higher, and we want them to use genetically modified seeds that are disease resistant. And so we learned a lot about how to do that by going into farming communities and identifying network leaders and convincing them to plant the corn. And then you can compare the fields, right? You can compare the wilted corn to the healthy, vibrant corn. And so you have like a very visible representation of the effectiveness of this new strategy. And if you can get that network leader to do that, you can often get other people to change their behavior as well. And a whole science of diffusion of innovation and implementation science, as most popularized by Everett Rogers, has developed out of that. And for those of you who are interested in this, I highly recommend the book Diffusion of Innovation, which presents a very exciting way of thinking about these issues. But now we've begun to apply that to the kinds of psychosocial research we do. And these terms are often tossed around. I just wanted to offer some definitions of them. That we think of, when I talk about an innovation, I'm talking about something that's an idea or a practice that's perceived as new to the people we're working with. Then they have a decision-making process about how to do that. We can disseminate, that is, we can increase awareness and make the intervention available, but that's a somewhat passive step, and what we really need is adoption, implementation, and then we want the intervention to sustain, that is, we want maintenance. And that's the way we have been thinking about how do we want to partner with the district. We're very worried about, let me rephrase that, we try and think about sustainability from moment one, because one of the things that creates some distrust between community partners and researchers is when the researcher comes in, has grant dollars to implement a program, the community or the school becomes dependent on that program, and then the grant dollars end, and the program ends, and they are now left with, in some ways, worse off than they were before. And so it's very important to think about the sustainability part in these partnerships right up front. So people have applied this to human services. Aubin offered one model from John Landsberg. There's another model that he's part of as well that was published by Enola Proctor, where we have an intervention strategy. We need to pair that with implementation strategies, and what the implementation strategy is may affect the intervention design itself. And then we have a lot of outcomes we want to think about measuring. Usually, we're all the way over on the right. We are thinking about satisfaction, functioning, and symptoms, right? But there are some things more proximal to the implementation that we also may want to study, like how is that service implemented, and then is it feasible? Are teachers or clinicians able to implement it the way it was designed? Is it acceptable to them? Will they continue to use it after we leave? And these things become an additional important set of variables that we have to add, because if we don't see good outcomes, we need to know why, because we need to know what the levers are we need to push. And sometimes it's the way it was implemented, but often there are other things as well that could be very important, which we won't know unless we add these kinds of measures to our effectiveness trials. I'm going to give you one example of that in autism, a very enterprising doctoral student, Hilary Dingfelder, who borrowed from the Wharton School of Business these measures that they used to measure manufacturing processes. That is, when Toyota retools its plant and has a whole new set of processes that they put in place, they're basically asking for behavior change. They're asking for the workers in that plant to do things differently. And you can, one of the ways to measure the extent to which that will be successful is by looking at the extent to which the intervention or the manufacturing change, the innovation itself, is expected, supported, and rewarded, or the workers feel that that's the case. And so she took these measures and she adapted them for the STAR program and used them to measure innovation implementation climate in our teachers, in our STAR classrooms. And what she found, as you might expect, is that there's a moderate correlation between climate and program fidelity. So we measured climate at baseline in September when we began to implement the program, and they've been through the initial training, and then we looked at fidelity over time. And if you look at fidelity at the end of the year, it's highly correlated or moderately correlated with that beginning sense of, you know, whether the intervention is expected. Is my principal expect me to use it? Is it supported? Am I getting the training and consultation I need? And is it rewarded? Do I see some positive outcome as a function of this training? So making sure that we hit those targets early in the process and engage principals, which was something that we kind of forgot to do initially and then did a lot of backpedaling, that those teachers feel like they're supported and that we ask them what we can do to make them feel most supported and then help them think about what expected outcomes for this program would be and how they know it will work. It's working, which I think is really what reward is about. What's very interesting to us is that there's an interaction between climate and fidelity on outcomes. So where we get the best outcomes is in high climate, high fidelity classrooms, as you would expect. If the teachers feel it's expected, supported, and rewarded, and they implement it the way it's designed, then you get good outcomes for kids. Where we get the second best outcomes are where there's low climate, low fidelity. And we think that what's happening is these teachers are saying, this program is not right for these schools. It's not expected. I'm not getting the support I need to implement it, and we're not being rewarded for its use. And so they may be making thoughtful decisions about what to implement instead that turn out to be almost equally effective as implementation of STAR. And we think we have a lot to learn from those teachers about what they're doing instead. And then when there's a disconnect between climate and fidelity, we get low outcomes. And this has actually been, in some ways a replication of what we found in other studies in children's mental health services. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with multisystemic therapy, which is an intervention for children with conduct problems. And there was a randomized trial of community mental health clinics where they offered them training in multisystemic therapy, so the content, or an organizational intervention to change the climate and culture of the organization around that implementation, or they offered them both or neither. So it was a 2x2 randomized design. And where you saw the significant reduction in clinical symptoms in kids is where they offered both interventions. So that's if you look at the dotted line where it's sort of yes for ARC, which is the organizational intervention, and yes for MST, that's where you see the significant reduction in child psychopathology. And so it may be when we think about implementing interventions, we need to think about both those sets of factors and addressing both those sets of factors. It's not just about content. It's not just about training, but it's also about the climate and culture of the organization in which we're doing that training. So organizational interventions are hard, and they're really, it's very difficult, I think, to conceptualize them on a large scale. It makes it difficult for study design because now your unit of analysis is the organization rather than the teacher or the child. And this has huge implications for statistical power. And so one of the things we've become very interested in as well is, well, we know these organizational interventions show promise. Can we intervene on the teacher level even in settings where the climate and the culture may not be as conducive to this? Can we offer the teacher the supports they need to do this? And to do this, we've been borrowing from models of behavior change that were really developed to think about things like drug use or condom use and focusing on adult behavior change. So I guess we're equating implementing these interventions with sex and drugs. But we can think about a behavior, and to a large extent, what we're talking about is adult behavior change on the part of the teacher. And these models posit, like the theory of planned behavior, theory of reasoned action, that the most proximal thing to behavior is intention. Does the teacher intend to do these behaviors? And that intention is a function of their attitudes, their norms, and their self-efficacy around that. In this case, this practice, attitudes, is this a good thing for me to do? Norms, are my peers doing it, right? And would they expect me to do it? And self-efficacy, do I have the skills that I need to do it? And often when we intervene, we focus on self-efficacy, right? That's the sort of the function of our training. But if self-efficacy is not the issue, we need to think about interventions that focus on attitudes and norms as well. And as part of this, we're trying to pilot different consultation strategies. One of the strategies we're piloting is targeted performance feedback. Targeted performance feedback is you go in to consult with the teacher, you come up with a list of goals for the teacher, and these goals become a work product for the teacher, and then you present to the teacher a visual display of their how much they've done, what it is that you've agreed that they will do, and what the outcomes are for the kid. And you're coming in on a laptop, you're typing in their data, and you're showing them these graphs. And if they're not doing it, you troubleshoot with them what's going on, how can I help you implement this. And as they are able to do it, you can then step back the consultation. So in this, what I'm going to show you, you're doing it every day, and then you're stepping back to every other day, then once a week, then once a month. And if they slip below 80%, you then step it up again. So it's very intensive. And the way we decided to do this was, well, let's take our teachers who have been in our study for 3 years and have never implemented discrete trial training. So these are folks who are like, yeah, we'll be in your little study, sure, whatever. And we'll complete the measures, but we're not going to do discrete trial training. We don't like pulling the kids for one-to-one work, and we'd rather do stuff in a group. And so we went in and we explained the project to them, and we asked them if they would be amenable to participating in this and doing discrete trial, measuring their discrete trial training. And the three of them said yes. And so we have single subject design currently with these three teachers. But one of the things you see is that once we started targeted performance feedback, it jumps to 100% for discrete trial training. And so one possibility is it's aversive. You're trying to get rid of the consultant, right? And so, but we also think that there are some normative issues and some self-efficacy issues that we're addressing in doing this. Now, this is based on their self-report of the work product and data collection. We still need to go in and do direct observation to see how they're doing it. But I think it holds some promise for intervening directly with the teacher, but it does suggest that has to be very intensive, at least initially, and then can be stepped back. Another way that people are thinking about this is through behavioral economics. It's sort of thinking about other levers, and could we find reinforcers that are external to the intervention for the teacher? We often think that implementing these interventions is intrinsically rewarding. Well, it's not. It's hard. And why would they want to do it? Why would they want to do something different than what they're doing if they've been getting by doing it for a decade? And so trying to think about other motivators, it's sometimes difficult to pay them, but we've been able to come up with levels and reward systems and certificate programs that they're often very responsive to. They're what Jay McGonigal in Reality is Broken refers to as meaningful but valueless. Right? They have no financial value, but they become very meaningful to the teacher. And I think that's an important area for us to explore. But autism interventions are really complicated. And so, we're asking teachers to do a lot of things all at once. And it's not clear that if we have multiple strategies that, we may just overwhelm the teacher and can be paralyzing for the teacher. So we've started to think about it in terms of duct tape and WD-40. Right? So I don't know if you've seen this engineering flow chart. Does it move? No. Should it? No. Don't do anything. Yes. Use WD-40. Does it move? Yes. Should it? No. Duct tape. Right? And so what are the minimal requirements that we can have for these teachers? And what we've begun to think is that here's what we're asking them to do. We're asking them to use positive reinforcement as a pervasive strategy throughout the day. We're asking them to use visual schedules. We're asking them to do data collection and only probe data. We don't ask them to do more than that. And we're asking them to pull kids for one-to-one. And so here's a classroom, what we think of as a successful classroom, where the teacher is implementing these four strategies. And she's and you'll notice it's not even one-to-one, it's 2-to-1, because she has an aide who has a physical disability and it's hard for her to move, and so this is the best that she can do. But we've started to think about what are really the active ingredients that we can pull, and instead of asking them to do these complicated programs, ask them to do very specific, very measurable things that that they can implement in the classroom. And we think, especially in these under-resourced areas, if you can get that foundation down, those fundamentals down, you can make really substantial changes in kids' outcomes. So if here, these last two slides are sort of my take-home messages from what we've done. One is didactic training does not result in behavior change. You have to include some kind of consultation. That consultant has to have a relationship with the intervention. And we also have to think about incentives, which we have not thought about because we've often thought about it as being intrinsically rewarding. So what should those incentives be? In terms of study design, there's intensive upfront work that has to happen with your community partner. The fact is they don't care about your study. They don't care about research. It's not, and I don't mean that in a mean way, it's not part of their mission. And so how do you engage them in identifying a question that's part of their mission? What is it that they're trying to change? And it's usually a process, like being sued or getting kids to, in our case, to transition to kindergarten instead of taking an extra year of early intervention, or staff retention, or something that's important to them, and how are you going to target that? We have to choose interventions that are feasible, that are affordable, where we can develop local expertise so that they sustain. And that's why we've sort of pared it down to these four components where we think that we need to start. And then you need to think about a staged implementation. One of the things we learned is you can't teach discrete trial training, pivotal response training, and teaching and functional routines to teachers in their first professional development day and expect them to do them all. Right, you're all like, duh, but it took us a year to figure that out. And so we've now thought about scaffolding training, and Aubin has some very nice fidelity data showing that when we really hammer in DT to them, they get very good at it, but they won't do it because they don't know how to organize the rest of their class. When we spend the first semester teaching them classroom management and teaching them functional routines, and then we add the one-to-one pieces, they're very happy to pull their kids because now their classroom has a structure and an organization that will survive when they're working with a kid one-on-one. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take questions. And if people have questions later, I'm also happy to field them by email. So yeah, questions for anyone on the panel, I think.
Hi, David. I had a question. So to what extent have you been able to take advantage of, let's say, a particular teacher who is already really motivated and deciding can sort of serve as a champion? And how would you suggest kind of looking for those people and using them in a way to sustain the intervention past the point when you've packed up and left?
That's a wonderful question that we're struggling with right now, and here's what we want to do. Here's what we're working towards. Teachers, like everybody else, like to be told that they're great. And the best way, I think, to engage those experts in this inherently isolating job is to tell them they're great, is to go in and observe what they're doing and say, this is fantastic. We'd like to set up a situation in which you can be a mentor to other teachers. And there are models like learning collaboratives, which are very expensive to run. One of the things that we were thinking about doing is creating a master teacher designation. The master teacher designation does not come with any additional salary. But what it does do is we can set up highly valued practicum placements for student teachers. And if we can get student teachers in those rooms that already have a lot of experience and we can get them emergency certified, then we can free up the teacher to visit other classrooms in her area. And so that's the structure that we're trying to set up so that she can be a mentor to other teachers in that area. There are a lot of logistics and union issues to work through, but I think it's a viable system. And of course, there are increasing interest in autism, and so those students are very interested in working with a master teacher, and the teacher is very excited to have the additional support. So that's the strategy that we're taking now. The other thing is during our professional development days, we've realized that professional development is more about community building than it is about stuffing teachers with training. And so we've tried to set up our professional development so that teachers have a lot of opportunity to interact and to share information and experiences with each other, and less slides in the front and more interaction at the table.